Good evening. James McKenna here with my Science Hour for October 7, 2021. And wow, some very diverse and interesting topics tonight. First of all, Europe heading into winter. They have invested heavily into so-called alternative energy. And, of course, they compounded their issues when they shut down their nuclear fleet. And, you know, after Fukushima, they just said no more nuclear, which I think is a good idea. But they did not put in conservation programs that would account for the loss of energy. Now, in the United States, for example, we get about 7% of our energy from nuclear power. So anybody that has the fantasy that somehow we're going to build up nuclear power like Obama wanted to do, of course, not a scientist, not an engineer, not even a mathematician, not even a third grade level mathematician, to understand that, you know, there's the cost of a nuclear power plant. We're talking, you know, $10 billion minimum for a small one. To replace the entire country, we're talking trillions of dollars. But, you know, 10 years in development, there's a nuclear power plant that just was, the construction ceased in the United States, and it had been under construction for decades. It was the last planned nuclear power plant in the U.S. So no, don't even think about nuclear power in the United States. It just is not going to happen. But in the United States, we could shut down the use of electricity by simply turning the light off. We waste tremendous amounts of electricity. And there's, you know, this is one of the things that bugs me. If there's out there the global climate change people and everything, you know, we got to save the world. I have never heard anyone of them ever say, hey, we got to conserve energy. We just got to stop using so much. And all we got to do, for example, we could shut down the whole nuclear fleet by of power plants, nuclear power plants, we could shut them all down today by simply turning off the light in the other room. Yeah. Or turning lights off and you're going to LED lighting. And literally that's how much energy is wasted in the United States every day and more. So, but back to Europe. Oh, boy. So they shut, Germany shut down all the nuclear power plants, which is a good idea, but they did not put in any conservation efforts because politicians, what do they know? Nothing. They're just, you know, fast talkers and wear a suit, pantsuit or a dress, you know, women wearing a dress, maybe some of the men wearing dresses too, some of the women wearing pantsuits, whatever. Doesn't matter. They're, you know, they're dressed up, lips, you know, it's like they say, a pig with lipstick. They don't know anything. Politicians typically know very little. I've talked to some of them, and it's like you get over the first level of technicality in a conversation, and you get this glazed over look, and they're going to give you some philosophical statement about something. They don't know anything. They don't know anything. Well, anyway, Europe is facing a conundrum because it's cold, just happens to be cold in Europe in the wintertime. You know, it's north of the United States, so they're like equivalent of Canada if you look at a map. Let me just do this now. In fact, I have a little globe. I've got one of these little desk globes. It's really great. A lot of times I look at things here and want to have a question about geography or something. But anyway, if you take Europe in general, France and Germany. Germany is the equivalent of the Northwest Territories. France is the equivalent of Nova Scotia, and only Spain drops down to a level where it would be the equivalent of like Maine. And the southern tip of Spain is the equivalent of like, oh, what do we got here? Washington, D.C. You know, that's the southern point. Italy, the southern point of the boot on Italy, we're talking about New York City. New York City, that's the southern tip of Italy. So Europe is a cold place. It's, you know, they need a lot of heat there. And, of course, they never built to have conservative building techniques or structure using ground or natural materials. And so they're dependent. They're very dependent on heat. And, of course, heating with electricity is one of the worst ways to use energy possible, because it's a very expensive form of heat. There are a lot of places that only have electric heat. In the United States, we're fortunate we have a lot of natural gas, and so a lot of places have natural gas, but in the southern U.S., a lot of it is electric. But anyway, and I guess they learned that in Texas last winter when you had the, or last, what was it? Yeah, when they had the Texas electric outage there, a lot of people's houses froze. And even if you have gas heat, natural gas, your furnace still needs electricity to operate. But anyway, if you're looking at Russia, you know, in Eastern Europe, it's even farther north. But the point is, they're not going to have enough energy to get through the winter. They're not even going to have enough energy to get through, even with halfway decent wind. But the other thing is that three-blade wind turbines do not do well in very cold weather. The material hardens up in the blades, and then the snow sticks to it. If it rains and then it snows, you can't use them. You can't spin around something that's caked with ice. There's some funny photographs, and they're not funny, they're real. There's a helicopter up there spraying this corrosive material on a three-blade wind turbine to try and undo the ice so that they can spin again and create electricity. I mean, what an incredibly bad idea. Which, by the way, people ask me, would the wing generator work in the wintertime? And the answer is yes, because the wing has wings and sails, and the sail material, the snow does not stick to it. It just falls right off, and because they're flexible. In fact, that's the principle they use on aircraft to where they have icing issues. They have actually material that can move, and it breaks off the ice, and the ice falls off, rather than having de-icer, which is another highly pollutant chemical that they use to get the ice off of wings. But anyway, I digress. Excuse me. Back to Europe and their energy problem. They're facing winter, and their only source of energy to heat their houses is the gas pipelines that come out of Russia. And so they're completely dependent on Russia, their arch enemy. So they've invested heavily in wind and solar. And, of course, solar in Germany in the wintertime, excuse me. I mean, I just can't even believe it. You know, these alternative energy companies, Siemens and other related companies, just must be laughing all the way to the bank, because they got the government to fund their crapola and have it installed over there. And in the United States, not to such a degree as Europe. But they're cruising for a bruising. And it's, you know, Russia could just, like Putin did at one point, said, well, yeah, I guess we're not getting along too good. I guess we're just going to turn off the pipeline. And Europe is going to have some cold toesy woesies coming this winter. Very interesting to see that. And the politicians, of course, causing this. Okay, now the next story, Facebook goes down. Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. The thing that's amazing to me is the reaction of people. The reaction that, oh my goodness, this was like the end of the world. A day without Facebook. I can't visit with my friends on Facebook. I don't get my Facebook fix for the day. I mean, people were like, I was like, you people are crazy. I have Facebook page that I use for the business. I have the JMCC Wing Facebook page. Then I've got the JMCC Water Filters Facebook page, like for business. But they're very simple. They're mainly to redirect to the web page, etc. But my life does not revolve around my visiting my friends on Facebook. So this is just, and I watched people, they turned to watching television, sit in front of the TV all day. And that's, you know, because they needed some kind of electronic fix to lock their brain in. And I'm like, oh my goodness, the world has kind of just gone mad over the last 10, 15 years with cell phones, with electronic communications, now with 5G. I mean, you have to download that video in less than 3 minutes, don't you? How can you possibly live without that? But Facebook going down, I just wonder if that's an omen, if that's kind of like a wake-up call to all of the just, you know, and here's something too. They have done studies on people who are playing video games and addicted to Facebook, doing selfies and things like that. And it's the equivalent of, in terms of your brain activity, it's the equivalent of doing heroin. So imagine all of the kids in the United States, in the new, you know, in the so-called developed countries, being affixed, and lots of adults too. I mean, don't leave those people out, because they're as addicted, if not more addicted, to the handheld device in their hand than to coffee. And I've seen some coffee addicted people, and oh my goodness, that is pretty amazing to see also. Anyway, back to the addiction, and it's a mental addiction. And you know, there's something too where the parents just have lost control. How many parents can go into their kid and say, you know, I'm taking away your phone. You're going to have to live for the next year. When I was a kid, for example, we had a fixed telephone, and the only time I used it was to call up some buddies to go, hey, yeah, you want to, let's go get a game of football together, some baseball. We'll meet you down at the park, you know, in such and such a time. Get on your bicycle and ride down there. And then, but that's what the phone was used for. Other than that, it was not sitting there chatting or talking or carrying on mindless conversations for hours. It was just a bling, ding, ding, quick call. Hey, see you down at the park in 5 minutes. Okay, bye. Boom. That was it. Now people's lives revolve around having that thing in their hand all day. Oh my goodness. And I have these things that I use for tools, my computer, my phone, you know, a tablet, things like that. And for travel, you know, sure. But I use them for work, and they're tools. They're things to help me progress and stay up on my business things, and a little bit of social activity moved in, mixed in there too. But it's, my life does not revolve around Facebook. And if Facebook goes down, it's not a crisis. It's not a psychological crisis in my life. Oh my goodness. To see this. Okay, enough of that. Comet Bernardinelli Bernstein. I've talked about this comet before. It's a big one. It's a big one, and I'm going to go through a little bit more detail, because some people wrote in and they did not understand what I was saying before about this comet and how big it is. And I kind of went through that relatively quickly on a previous show, but I'm going to talk about something, a term in science and astronomy called albedo. Albedo is the amount of light, the percentage, here's very simply, it's the percentage of light that reflects off of an object. So if you, say, have a perfectly white object and you have a light source shining on that object, or even a mirror could have an albedo because it's reflecting the light, and then it absorbs some light. So say you have a light shining on a piece of white material and the light is reflected off of that, and you measure the amount of light that's leaving your light towards the object, and then you measure the light that's coming back off of that per square inch or per square meter or whatever. And the percentage loss that is absorbed by the object, you subtract that from 1, the percentage, and that is your albedo. So an albedo of 1 is 100% reflective. That means all of the light that comes to it is reflected off of it. If you have a black object, then it's perfectly black, and what there's a term in physics, it's called the black body. In other words, it's a perfect absorber of any radiation that comes to it, and then it gets off heat energy in the form of infrared, and there's a whole one of Einstein's great theoretical works is dealing with the radiation coming off of black bodies and understanding it, and some other physicists as well. But anyway, if you have a perfectly black object, which is the case for comets, we know that when you look at the surface of a comet, it's perfectly black, and it has very low albedo, very close to zero. In other words, it absorbs most of the light, and literally nothing reflects off of it, or very, very little, like a small portion of 1% reflects off the comet nucleus. So now, in previous weeks, I've been talking about electric highways to the stars. And I mentioned in that discussion regarding the electrical discharge, especially of large comets. Now, this comet is going to be big, and it's already forming a tail. It's out beyond the orbit of Neptune, meaning that the sun is like another star. There's no energy from the sun arriving at this comet to cause a comet tail by the Dirty Snowball Comet model. So rather than admit that it doesn't make any sense, they just kind of brush the facts under the rug, under the theoretical rug, and just pretend like, oh, yep, Dirty Snowball again. Just what we expected. What I said is that these kind of comets, the big ones, can be used for magnetic braking of an alien spacecraft. And so I'm just saying, I'm not predicting that aliens are coming or going to use it. I just am saying that, in fact, one of the things that came out of Hale-Bopp and one of the things that freaked out the CIA, and I mean, I'm telling you, they freaked out big time, was that there were alien signals coming from the region around Hale-Bopp. In other words, there was an alien spaceship, according to the CIA. This is not me talking. This is the CIA in the background, and you never heard this in public. But this is what made them freak out, and they also freak out when groups of people get together and want to go out and sit on a hillside and put their psychological prowess together and to communicate with aliens. And so anyway, the Heaven's Gate people were just about to do that when 37 of them magically died in a so-called suicide, which was not a suicide. It was a mass murder, because the CIA wants to have total ultimate control for their banker employers, the European bankers, the Vatican Bank. And so whether there were aliens or not, or whether the comet was just making the signaling itself, is not the point. The CIA was freaking out. And so anyway, what I'm saying is Comet Bernardinelli Bernstein is a comet much bigger than Hale-Bopp. And Hale-Bopp, by the way, you read my book, Planet X 2020, The Real Story of Planet X, or The Real History of Planet X, is a description of the events, a lot of these events dealing with the comet Hale-Bopp. You should really read this. I'm not going to repeat it on this show. But Bernardinelli Bernstein is a much bigger comet, meaning it's going to have a much bigger electrical discharge, meaning it's going to have a much bigger magnetic field related to it, which means it's has the capability of braking, magnetic braking, a much larger spacecraft coming in full of aliens. And it's supposed to be here. I'm not saying that there are aliens coming. I'm just saying these are the physical facts. And, you know, if you were going to, let's say, for example, if you were going to leave the nearest star system, which is about a 7-year ride away, if you're using the technique that I explained on shows before, and this is dealing with electric highways to the stars, if you were going to go to the next star system, you would have, it's 4 light years away, it's about a 7-year trip. And that is accelerating at 1G, one Earth gravity acceleration, for half of the trip. In fact, you don't even accelerate half of the trip until you get up to 3/4 of the speed of light. You don't go faster than that. And now you travel, you cruise between the stars at that speed until you hit a point where you start slowing down at 1G. And you come in, and it's about a 7-year trip to get to the nearest star using this technique and the electric highways to the stars that I described. And like I say, back in the year of, you know, when I was at Cornell, we're talking 1979, and I'm realizing these things. By 1982, I was in Los Angeles looking for funding for my projects and dealing with this. And, you know, the physicists there had no clue. These were people at the top of aerospace corporations in the United States. And these people had, I was coming in with brand new concepts, brand new physics. And I talked at Los Alamos National Laboratory. I talked with Space America Air Show. I talked at the 19th International Electric Propulsion Conference, which is a closed military meeting, and many more other venues on this topic. So, and other related topics. And of course, at the time, nobody had a clue. So I was in like a, I was like a person with all of this information, all this theoretical work, all this scientific work done, and nobody had a clue. Nobody had a clue. And then in the late 1980s, Robert Harrington of the Naval Observatory starts picking up on Hale-Bopp. And finally confirms it in 1991, and that's when the roof came in on NASA. That's when things changed. But anyway, getting back to Comet Bernardinelli Bernstein, it's going to be in the solar system in 2031. That'll be its closest approach to the sun, but it's going to be way out by the orbit of Saturn, according to NASA, according to the experts. So we'll see. We'll see about that. But they allegedly, mistakenly thought this was a dwarf planet. And then all of a sudden it starts developing a tail. And now imagine, here's the story, that they're spinning. They knew this was a dwarf planet. They knew it was coming into, they knew its orbit, so they knew it was coming into the solar system, but they didn't say anything. And this is on an orbit that goes way out. It's a million of year orbit. And so they knew that there was a planet coming into the solar system, and they did not tell you. Now, that is proof positive, and now they had to short-circuit this because it started turning into a comet, and amateur astronomers were going to discover it, just like Hale-Bopp, so they had to cut that off at the pass. An old expression from old Westerns, if you're not familiar with that. Head them off at the pass, meaning that the bad guys had to ride through this pass, and you got your guys with the guns there to head them off at the pass. And so anyway, that's what the standard scientific community is doing. They prevented some amateur from discovering this as a comet, which happened with Hale-Bopp. They knew about Hale-Bopp since 1991, but it was coming in as a planet. So nobody said anything, and all of a sudden one night, bam, it explodes. It discharges the solar capacitor, flashes into brightness, and Hale and Bopp discover it on the same night. And all of a sudden the CIA's got a big problem on their hands. And that's when the pictures went off to Art Bell. He posted them on his webpage. The Courtney Brown, the Chuck Schrammick photos. Chuck Schrammick was a friend of mine, a talk show host from Houston. I had been on his radio show numerous times, He was a very big critic of NASA, which in Houston, that's NASA's home base, like, Houston, we have a problem. It's called Chuck Schramick. He's a radio talk show host. And he's having James McCanney on the radio telling Houston about what a bunch of idiots NASA is. Anyway, this is what's going on back in those days. Let's just put it that way. And so they had to short circuit this comet from being discovered by an amateur. That's what I'm telling you to have. And as it is, it's being given the name of its discoverers, but these guys work for an observatory. These guys observed this on an automated planetary search as a planet. So understand this, boys and girls, grandmas and grandpas out there. Remember how NASA always said, well, if there's a Planet X, we will tell you about it. We're honest and we're trustworthy. We tell you about it. Here's a perfect example, 100% concrete, perfect example of a planet coming into the solar system, and NASA just kind of forgot to mention it. Ooh, okay. And now it's turned into a comet. Gee, Emmanuel Velikovsky. Wow. I mean, these people have no conscience. These people have no conscience at all. Okay, so now I'll just talk a little bit about albedo and how big is this comet nucleus, actually. And so what they're saying in the news, that it's 160 kilometers across. So that's about 100 miles. So now, here is what I said on my show before and people did not understand. So I'm going to repeat it with hopefully a bit more clarity. And so that everybody can understand this. Now, I mentioned this idea of albedo. Albedo is the reflectivity of the object. For example, Venus, which you can see up in the night sky, or has a very high albedo, meaning that it's very bright. And the actual value is 0.75. So 75%, three quarters of the light that arrives to Venus from the sun is reflected off the cloud tops. And this is because, yeah, Venus has high percentage of carbon dioxide, and it appears in the atmosphere as kind of a carbon dioxide steam, and it's very bright. And so a comet nucleus is assumed to be even much brighter. It's like snow. They're assuming it's a snowball. In fact, let me jump into this article just to read the the baloney they're trying to pass off onto you, the public, here. Let me just grab one of these articles here. It is at an estimated 93 miles wide, comet Bernardinelli-Bernstein comet is believed to be the largest comet ever discovered. And let's see here. They compare it to Hale-Bopp. They go, the average this, I'm reading this from a mainstream media article that is being passed around. And so they're saying that the diameter of Hale-Bopp was around 37 miles, which is a lie. Comet Hale-Bopp was planetary size. It had a mass about four Earth masses of the nucleus. And the saying that the comet Bernardinelli-Bernstein could be as much as 17 times larger and just under three times the size of Hale-Bopp in diameter, which means if it's three times, then it's three to the three cubed in terms of mass. So that would be 27 times as massive as Hale-Bopp. So if Hale-Bopp, you know, consider they're lying, of course, and that Hale-Bopp was four Earth masses, 27 times that, we're talking greater than 100 Earth masses, so something that is very, very large, very large. And here's the issue, too, with this concept of measuring albedo, and here's what I tried to explain before, and that did not come through very well. And by the way, in this article, they talk about the Oort cloud, this imaginary cloud of comets that is from fairy tale astronomy that's still being taught in graduate school all the way from kindergarten to graduate school astronomy. And it never could be discovered, never ever has been discovered. It's just a theoretical concept that fits with their narrative, which is typical of the loony liberal universities. You know, it's like if you took an economics course in a university, they're still talking supply and demand. Oh, my goodness, it has very little to do with real economics. Anyway, okay, so now let's take a quarter, a 25-cent money piece, or let's do this. Let's take a golf ball. That's a perfect example, a pure white golf ball. You shine a light on it. You're in a dark room. The only thing that's there is the golf ball. You shine a light on it, and it reflects light back to you. And let's say that it has an albedo of 1. So it perfectly reflects all the light that hits it back to you. And you say, okay, based on what this reflectivity is in our assumption and the amount of light that's coming from the sun or from our light source in the case of the golf ball in a room, you can make an estimate of the size of the golf ball based on the albedo, the assumed albedo. So what you're doing here is you are assuming that the golf ball has an albedo of 1, and therefore, and you know that because you know a golf ball is white. You've seen them in the daylight. You've golfed with them. You've seen your other friends golf with them. They're white. But what if you've never seen this object? And someone puts it out there, and all you see is a certain amount of light being reflected. Now, let's take a perfectly black golf ball with very low albedo, and we're going to ask the question, how many black golf balls do you need to reflect the same amount of light as the one white light bulb? And this is where we're getting at, because all of a sudden, now you're going to, if say the albedo of the golf ball is 1, that's what we're assuming, it reflects perfectly 100% of the light that falls on it. But the albedo of the black golf ball is like 0.1. So it's 1,000 times less reflective than the white golf ball. That would mean to get the same amount of light back to you, you're going to need something with a surface area that's 1,000 times bigger. Okay? It's 1,000 times bigger, so that's 1,000 golf balls. Now, if you took those 1,000 golf balls and put them in a circular pattern, all kind of scrunched them together, that means that the square root of that, or about 35, let's just say 35 is the square root of 1,000. 35 times 35 is 1,000. And these are approximate numbers. Then, now let's talk about the mass, because the mass is the cube of the radius. And so now we have 33 times the diameter cubed. We're talking about, here, let's just do a quick calculation. And I'm going to use 33 here instead of 35. It works out much closer to the 1,000. So 33 times 33 is, let me just do this over again. I'm just getting ahead of myself here. That's 1,089. Okay, so now you have to multiply that by 33 again, and you get 35,937, which is about 36,000. So that means that the volume of your black golf ball to reflect the same amount of light as your one white golf ball with 1,000 difference in albedo, and that's the difference that is the actual difference between a white snowy comet nucleus, assumed to be the color, the reflectivity of a snowball, perfectly reflecting white snowball, and 0.1% albedo, 0.1 albedo of the real comet nucleus that we have measured. That's 1,000 times different. And so the end result is that the black golf ball that you would have that would give back the equivalent amount of light as the one little white light bulb would have a mass 36,000 times greater than the white golf ball. Now, do you see where this is going? So what they're doing in astronomy world, in fairy tale astronomy world, they're assuming that that comet nucleus is perfectly white, reflects 100% of the light that reaches it from the sun. They're, with that estimate, they're making an estimate of the size 100 miles across. Now, because of the albedo difference between the white snowball that they're assuming and the real surface of a comet, which is 1,000 times different albedo, that means that the physical size that you would see if you took our black real planet out there that you see, that size is estimated not by pixels on a telescope, but by albedo. And by the way, they have these calculations too, and they're, so they know they're lying. So these jokers, Bernardelli and Bernstein, know because they saw this as a dwarf planet before it became a comet. So they know that their jefes, their bosses, are lying to you. And now they got to sit in their little cube in their little university, their little study cube at the observatory, and understand that they're being broadcast, and I hope they're listening, because they understand what I'm talking about. These bozos are being used. Their names are being put out there on a lie, which I'm exposing them right now. But they don't have a voice because they can't walk up to a microphone. If they did, they're going to lose their future. They would never look through another telescope again, ever again. They'd be off to McDonald's flipping hamburgers, and they know it. So they got to shut up. They got to sit in their corner and pretend like it's a dirty snowball. And I'd love to see one of these guys break rank, but they're too stupid. They're too green. They don't understand what they're doing. And if they did, they would be shut down so fast, and they know it. So literally, the nucleus of this comet that they're looking at is around 33 times 100 miles. So, and that's an estimate, and then you get up to the point where the comet nucleus is around 36,000 times, and these are round numbers, 36,000 times the mass of the comet nucleus. And so, to understand these numbers, how massive is a comet nucleus? How many of those would it take to make an Earth mass, etc.? Those are estimates that I'm not going to go into right now. But if you go back to the fact that Hale-Bopp, these are other comparisons. When you're dealing with having to read between the lines of liars, then you have to put other pieces of data together. And so, for example, with Hale-Bopp, we know from the Harrington work that it was four times the mass of Earth. It could have been smaller and very dense because there are things out in outer space that are extremely dense. They're a piece of chunk of something that came from, say, for example, deep in the heart of a star. So they're compressed much, much more dense than, say, granite. So the size of Hale-Bopp's nucleus may not have been physically four times that of Earth, but the Harrington estimate, and this is based on the calculations of pulling down on Uranus and Neptune. Something, by the way, this has kind of slipped off the radar in astronomical world since the 1700s when the Herschels were walking around. We're talking 1781 when Uranus was discovered, and then another half century later, the Neptune was discovered. They knew that there was something out there pulling on these planets. And at that time, the nucleus of Hale-Bopp was way out there, way out and down below. So it was actually pulling them out a bit. when Harrington discovered it in the late 1980s. The actual object, which became the nucleus of Hale-Bopp, which was literally the Planet X object that Harrington was looking for, under contract to NASA. We have the contracts that the Naval Observatory, where Harrington worked, was working on as contracts to NASA, literally called the search for Planet X. And that's what was pulling down on the Neptune and Uranus. And at that time, Hale-Bopp, the nucleus, and literally Planet X, which Herschel had been looking for since they realized right away, as soon as they discovered Uranus, that it wasn't following its correct orbit. And they were very tuned to this. I mean, they had this thing down very shortly after the discovery. And then when Neptune was discovered, they thought, oh, there it is. And then they realized, well, Neptune isn't the one pulling this out. Neptune is being pulled also. And so anyway, and then they found Pluto. And they thought, well, that's the one that's pulling out. And then they thought, well, no, that's not in the right position for whatever is pulling Neptune and Uranus around. And then, of course, later it was actually Robert Harrington who discovered that Pluto had a moon, and then they calculated, because it was, they could, that little calculation you can do when there's something orbiting something bigger. If you know the distance between them in the orbital period, you can calculate the mass of the central object. And so Harrington is the one that did that. That was one of his very famous discoveries when he was real young as the head of the Naval Observatory. He then verified that Pluto was much too small to be the one. And so they had been looking for this Planet X object forever, since 1781, literally, from the time they discovered Uranus. Okay, so anyway, back to my point. The mass that they determined there from those calculations was around 4 Earth masses, and that's in Harrington's work. And so, of course, he confirmed the sighting of what became the nucleus of Hale-Bopp. And by the way, if you want to read the details of this, this is all detailed in my book, The Planet X 2020, The Real History of Planet X. I go through all of this. I'm not going to repeat all that here. But anyway, we know from Harrington's study that Hale-Bopp's nucleus was around 4 times the mass of Earth, which was certainly not, you know, 40 miles across. Excuse me, boys and girls. And so anyway, and plus they have photos of Hale-Bopp on its way out after it stopped actively pursuing or producing a tail. And so they have pictures of it. They have, that's another story. And so they know in the inner circles that Hale-Bopp was planetary size, and that was, in fact, Hale-Bopp, but none of them can talk. They're all under gag orders from the CIA. Okay, so at any rate, if you take that comparison and then realize that even in public they're admitting that this comet Bernardinelli-Bernstein is probably at least 3 to 5 times bigger in diameter, in area, then that would tell you that you go back to the same calculations, the same reasoning, then that would make it potentially, and these are just rough numbers. These are just rough numbers because I'm trying to, as I say, read through a lie, but I'm pretty good at that. It goes back to when I was at Cornell and NASA would publish papers. I had to read the paper, understand the instrumentation that they were used, which was poorly designed, and then understand what was going on, because I knew what was going on for the electrical conditions around Jupiter and Saturn, etc. But that would make this object probably around 20 Earth masses. 20 Earth masses about. So this is big, but it's not. Now don't go jump up and down and say that McCanny is saying that, you know, Planet X is coming, we're all going to die. No, and there will be people who go that route, and so don't listen to them. The belief that this is going to come in around the orbit of Saturn, I find believable, because it's like the weatherman doesn't know what he's talking about when it comes to, say, hurricanes, for example. But they will tell you the wind speed of the hurricane, which is accurate. So there's certain things that you learn to trust from NASA. And one of the things that they probably have a certain level of trust for this, they might be lying. They always lie. Never a straight answer. But when it comes to the orbital predictions, then they're usually pretty honest. So I, at this point, believe that this comet, and plus it has a long history, it's been observed for a long time. So believing the orbit is something that I find believable at this point in time. I might change my mind in the future. I'd tell you about it if I do. But the idea that this is a many million mile orbit, that it's going to only come in close to the orbit of Saturn. The one thing, however, I will say, is that because of the tail drag, which is going to be extensive, the bigger the comet, the more effect the tail drag has on circularizing the orbit and energy depletion in the orbit, which means it's going to fall in. It's going to come in. It's going to come into a much lower orbit than predicted. So we don't know that yet. Hale-Bopp did it very pronouncedly, dropped into a much lower orbit. It came into the solar system. Hale-Bopp came into the solar system with a 4,200-year orbit and left with a 2,600-year orbit. Those are approximate numbers. So it lost all of that energy, all of that time in the orbit, in one single passage through the solar system. So if we assume that same thing, and it's a more exaggerated for this comet, Bernardinelli-Bernstein, it could drop in much farther into the solar system than Saturn. And there again, these are effects that are still we're starting to understand. It was very clear with Hale-Bopp, and of course they had to lie. They had to say, well, that was due to a perturbation of coming close to Jupiter. There was a slight perturbation due to Jupiter, but that's not what changed its orbit from 4,200 years to 2,600 years. In fact, Brian Marsden, long before it ever got to Jupiter, was republishing the ephemeris of Hale-Bopp on a daily basis. That's how much it was changing. And so this comet could also do that. Okay, so anyway, lots of things going on. I'm going to move on. I got a lot of other topics to cover here tonight. Oh, moving quickly, there's a disinformation piece floating around in the mainstream media that somehow the jet stream has an unprecedented shift north. And now this is complete baloney, and it's a lot of it based on speculation. So there's a study done by scientists. I love when they say that. Sounds so official. So that you better believe it, that this is due to global warming. Well, let me tell you, boys and girls, the jet stream has nothing to do with heat coming up from the Earth, and that's one of the false assumptions that I eradicate in my book, The Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun-Earth Weather. That concept just doesn't make any sense at all, that somehow sunlight comes in, heats up the atmosphere, and that causes the jet streams. It's an impossibility. It violates the three laws of thermodynamics. And you can't have an unconcentrated source of energy developing a concentrated source of energy. It just doesn't work that way. The jet streams are caused by the electrical currents that are in the upper atmosphere and also affect the lower atmosphere. They drag the atmosphere around. And these are the co-rotating bands of electrical current. The equatorial band goes westerly. I've talked about this in my books and my papers, and that's the one that drives the hurricanes that go west across. It's the vertical discharge in the, if you do a V cross B in the magnetic field of the Earth, the current coming upwards, the magnetic field of the Earth going north, and the force goes west. That's why hurricanes move west, is because of the electrical current driving them from the ionosphere. The majority of that current is in electrons coming down and ions coming up. And you look at that current, the I cross B, the velocity of the positive current crossed with the B field of the Earth gives you the force in the westerly direction. And so, anyway, the jet streams are forced, they are caused by the upper level ionospheric jet streams, etc. So the idea that somehow global warming is causing the jet stream to move north is just it's just bizarre. That's all I can tell you. And then, you know, the science has been lowered to what I call talky-talk science. You have some guy who's an authority, self-proclaimed authority on TV, and science has degraded into some self-proclaimed expert giving you talking points and assuring you that he or she is correct because of their authority. And of course, delimiting their story and denigrating anybody, any opposition. When I see this, it's just like, you know, science has become so watered down that, and the general public, because of the very poor public education, have become scientifically inept. And that's why you can pull over the scientific wool over their eyes so easily. And, you know, like an article still talking about dirty snowballs. You can't be serious. That went out. Nobody believes that anymore in the real world. I want to talk quickly about Hurricane Sam here, 150-mile-an-hour winds in the North Atlantic. You know, the idea that hurricanes are caused by warm water. Here you have a hurricane in the North Atlantic with frigid North Atlantic water with 150-mile-an-hour winds increasing. Just to mention also, the Canary Islands are in the news. I've been talking about this for a long time. And the idea that a landslide there could trigger a tsunami that would just devastate the entire eastern coast of South America, Central America, the Caribbean islands, the eastern coast of the United States. And we know from history that these tsunamis have come in as far as Pennsylvania. The coal mines and the coal fields of Pennsylvania were formed in Virginia from these tsunamis. So they're huge. And when they come in, there was a tsunami in Madagascar a number of years ago that resulted from the tsunami that erupted off of the coast of India. And that tsunami came all the way across the Indian Ocean, hit Madagascar, and it took out all of the vegetation and it piled it up against the eastern side of a mountain range there. And that is going to be cold someday. That's what tsunamis do. The really big tsunamis were the ones caused by planetary passages because of the gravitational wave of a large celestial object passing by Earth. But at any rate, so this is a real issue. This is a real issue for the entire eastern coast of the United States. 30% of the United States population lives in that tsunami zone. And don't talk to a politician about it. They're off busy planning infrastructure with, you know, $10 trillion spending packages. Oh, my goodness. Anyway, I don't want to go there anymore. Let me see. Oh, here's something I got to talk about. You will be seeing this more and more. This last week, I listened to a discussion that was in a foreign language, which I'm fluent in some foreign languages. I'm relatively good in other ones, but understood this complete speech in a foreign language. And what they're calling out is that the World Bank, the president of Japan, I think it was the lieutenant governor of Texas, his last name is Patrick, because the guy was speaking in a foreign country. He did not really understand the governorship or the titles in America and the United States. But anyway, this guy, I think he's lieutenant governor of Texas or related to the governor's office, also called for this. What they're calling for is for senior citizens of the world to go into a doctor and take a pill and die. I'm not kidding. And they're saying that this is necessary for the world economy. So this is coming along. And I think that's what the COVID thing was all about. One of the big pushes was to get a lot of elderly people to die because they think this is going to help out the world economy, which is the fault of the world bankers. these morons who control the money, which is not money, it's fiat money. The entire world economy and the dire state of the world based on huge international corporations pillaging countries for their natural resources for profit and gain is a disaster created by the World Bank. And so anyway, now they're blaming it on the seniors and like, oh, gee, we just can't support these worthless seniors anymore. And I'll tell you something, a lot of the corporations in the world are still employing seniors that are very old because they know how to do things. A lot of the newer generations don't know how to do anything. They went to college, they got a degree, they don't know how to do anything. So the seniors are going to be running the world for a long time to come. I got news for you. And what's interesting is that people like Bill Gates would be in the scenario. So according to their plan, Bill Gates should go in, get his pill and die. Him and Melinda. Go for it, Bill. You be first. There was like an article in a newspaper. It was a newspaper in Hawaii. In this one this one liberal senator there from the state senator, was claiming that people, because of overpopulation, should go jump off a cliff. But he didn't realize that people were going to tell him to go jump off the cliff first. And, of course, he didn't understand that. Why other people wouldn't volunteer, but he should have to go first. Anyway, this is coming down the road. This is coming down the road. These people are crazy. The people that have gotten power. And anyway, I just want to report that. And the president of Japan, one of the leaders of the International Monetary Fund, this joker from Texas, actually stating this, that seniors are worthless citizens and they should willingly die for the benefit of the world economic situation, which was created by the world bankers. Okay, I've got about a minute left here. I did not have time to get into the Colburn. There's a new book out. It's by Yvonne Whiteman. You can get it on Amazon. And it's called Sacred and Scandalous Egypt. And it's called Unlock the Mysteries of the Colburn. And there's two parts to it, Sacred and Scandalous Egypt and Genetic and Global Catastrophes. Just look for Yvonne, Yvonne, Whiteman, Whiteman. And I wanted to go into a long dissertation on my show tonight about this. I'll do this next week. It ties in with Electric Highways to the Stars and the History of Man. So go get that book. Also, my friend Mark Gaffney's book on Amazon. Also, on my webpage, use the coupon code JMCC, the four letters. You can get 10% discount on any of the water filter products on my webpage. The whole house water filter, the replacement filter elements for gravity feed, my great new sink stainless steel filter, etc. And I'm out of time. The webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com. My other webpage, jmccsci.com. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.